Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, happy to be here to introduce our show to you today, May 6, 2006. Today our focus is on immigration. Here's what we have coming up for you. Our news today will come from Media Minutes on internet privatization and more, followed by coverage of the Lowell, Mass. May Day Rally for Immigrant Rights. Following that, we bring you a panel discussion entitled Immigration Reform, Politics, Race, and Nation, which was held at USC Los Angeles. In our second hour, we bring you an excerpt from an analysis of recent news by Jav Parrish. Then hear more commentaries about the May Day rallies. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have great music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. Now we bring you Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Grassroots mobilization is making a difference in the congressional fight to preserve free speech online. Just last week, it seemed like the House of Representatives was poised to pass some terrible telecommunications legislation that would allow phone and cable companies to discriminate against online content providers depending on a speaker's ability to pay. But a broad and deep coalition banded together to pound Capitol Hill with a call to preserve the principle of network neutrality for the internet. It began with some 50 diverse organizations. That number has since multiplied eightfold. More than 2,000 bloggers took up the call, and more than 500,000 people have signed on to a petition supporting net neutrality safeguards. And the inventor of the World Wide Web is now on record in favor of a free and open internet. Meanwhile, lobbying groups fed by the major phone and cable companies are spending nearly $1 million a week running television advertisements in the Washington, D.C. market, which attempt to paint their drive to kill off an open internet as good for America. And major media companies are already working with phone and cable giants to secure preferential treatment for their content over new fiber optic broadband networks. Last month, CBS and Verizon announced an agreement whereby Verizon will carry CBS television programming over its new fiber optic system. CBS gets money plus, quote, the bandwidth and flexibility to reach customers in innovative ways, end quote. Does this mean that Verizon's fiber optic network will slow down or lock out non-CBS video? Nobody knows. The terms of the deal are private. But the politicians are waking up. At least two bills now circulate in the House that would prohibit data discrimination. They join two pending bills in the Senate that also seek to preserve internet freedoms. However, both houses also continue to work on comprehensive telecom bills filled with several other poison pills. For example, House legislation would take away local communities' rights to negotiate franchise agreements with cable TV providers, which stands to kill off public access television channels around the country. And in the Senate, telecom reform includes draconian provisions that would require digital TV and radio broadcasters to lock down their content with special encryption that would prohibit people from recording anything. The Senate bill would also prevent communities from establishing their own publicly owned broadband networks unless they built them with a private partner. The House of Representatives could send its comprehensive telecom bill to a floor vote any day now, while the Senate's not expected to act on the issue until sometime in June.
The Federal Communications Commission is finally taking the subject of radio payola seriously. New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer has been digging into pay-for-play scandals for the last 2 years. He's already secured tens of millions of dollars in settlement payments against two major record labels, and more are expected. Earlier this year, Spitzer turned his attention to the radio side of the payola equation, suing the 95-station Intercom broadcast chain for taking cash and gifts in exchange for song airplay. Spitzer's also examining the practices of Clear Channel, CBS Radio, and Citadel Broadcasting. Until now, the FCC's been watching the New York proceedings with detachment. But late last month, the agency finally began its own payola probe. For their part, the mega broadcasters attempted to preempt FCC scrutiny by offering to pay paltry settlements of their own. But the proposed payments didn't do justice to the scope of the illegality alleged in modern payola practices.
Yet another dubious journalistic milestone has been passed in the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq. More journalists have now died covering Iraq than were killed during all of World War II or the Vietnam War. The Virginia-based Freedom Forum reports that since the invasion of Iraq in 2003, 74 journalists from 20 countries have died covering the conflict. That compares to 69 journalist fatalities in World War II and 63 in Vietnam. The Iraqi Journalists Association, however, puts the death toll since 2003 at 112 and notes that, on average, 3 news workers were killed every month last year. In somewhat related news, a dubious journalistic practice from Iraq has found its way home. The Department of Homeland Security says it will begin embedding reporters with its personnel when they respond to floods, fires, hurricanes, and other mass emergencies. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff says the embed plan is designed to keep curious reporters from interfering with DHS emergency response efforts, but he pledged it would not be used to censor stories. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Next up, we have short interviews with participants at Lowell's May Day Immigration Rights Rally. Thinking Out Loud on WUML of Lowell, Mass. Did the interviews.
Hi, how are you doing, Victoria?
Oh, good. We got a decent crowd for Lowell, huh, for the first time?
Yeah.
It's exciting.
Hang on. Tell me how exciting it is. Hi, we're talking to Victoria Forberg from One Lowell.
Yeah, this is a really great day for us. It's the first time we've ever had an immigrant rally in the city of Lowell, at least as long as I've been here. And I just think it's great. It's really exciting that we've had such a good turnout. And that, you know what else is exciting? Is like there's Latinos and there's, you know, Anglos and there's Asians and there's Africans. And it's just great.
Hi, Victoria.
Hey, so fun.
No Brazilian?
Oh, there's Brazilians too. Yeah, sorry. How could I forget Brazilians? So it's just really great.
Okay, what's this all about, though?
This is about the immigrants. Okay, as you know, right now in the legislature, there's a lot of different bills that are both for and against giving immigrants access to a green card as well as to citizenship. And this is what this is about. It's saying, hey, we're here. We're working hard. This is a country of immigrants where everybody came over for this, you know, for varying reasons, but to flee persecution, for economic opportunities, for all kinds of different things. And we've been able to absorb everyone into this wonderful country that we have. And that's what these people want too.
We're talking to Maria Lopez, and she's here. Why?
I am here because I'm here in support of my fellow immigrants. I am a U.S. citizen. I'm from Puerto Rico, but I support immigration reform, and there should be a middle ground so that the people already here, they are our friends. They are our friends' family. They need to have some kind of support so that they don't have to leave to a country that they probably never even knew, if they came here very young. And why not give them the opportunity? I'm sure that more than half of America is composed of immigrants, whether legal or not.
All right. I'm talking to Father Ramon.
Hi, how are you? I'm Rich from St. Anne's Episcopal Church here in Lowell.
What's going on here?
Well, you know, I first of all, I'm a pastor. I've got a congregation with a number of people who were not born in this country. And not only that, I personally wasn't born in this country. I was 13 years old when I left Cuba in 1961. And my mother and the rest of my family were reunited with me 6 years later. And we've had wonderful care and benefits. Initially, when we came here from the government, we were able to get our citizenship, and I'm just here to support the rest of the people whom I hope will be able to accomplish the same thing we were able to accomplish.
Okay, thank you, Father Ramon.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you, Dan.
My name is Narita.
And why are you here?
Yeah, why I'm here? Because I just want them to support them also. And another point, just want to give them voice, to help them making voice. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And now, are you an immigrant?
Yeah, I am.
From where?
From Cambodia. I still handle asylum status.
Okay, we're talking to
Savannah Poof.
And why are you here, Savannah?
I'm here to support the immigrants within the nation, and I'm from UTEC, and I'm here to help them out.
And what is UTEC?
UTEC is a youth center in downtown Lowell, serving youth between 13 and 20 years old. It's for United Teen Equality Center.
How many people do you think are here?
For the whole place, I think like around, looks like around 100 to 150.
That's what everybody else thinks. So, you know, is there a problem with immigrants? What's going on?
I don't think there's a problem with immigrants. I think the immigrants are here to help us out, help the nation out, and today is a day for them to show to the nation that we are important people here and that we can be here to help out the economy. So we just want to show everybody that we're a big part of the community.
Are you an immigrant?
Yes, I am. I was born in Thailand. And I moved to the United States when I was like 1 year old. But I wasn't necessarily born here, so I'm an immigrant.
My name is Jose Perez, Jose Antonio Perez. I'm here because I'm trying to help, you know, all my people. I got family too, are immigrants. So we're trying to get ready united, because this country is made of different kind of people, especially Guatemalans, you know, Mexicans, Dominicans, Colombians, and Brazilians. So all those people help this country, you know, to raise it up. So hey, why not? Everybody should be treated the same, equal.
What country is your family from?
From Guatemala. Most of our life, we've been here, we live here, most of our countries. So, you know, you should be treated equally. So nobody should be less than us or more than us.
My name is Gordon Ham, and I live in Lowell. I come from Ghana. I'm here with my family. I have a wife and I have three boys.
And, you know, why are you here today?
Well, I'm here for the cause. For everybody here to be citizens of USA, and I know we have a lot to contribute. So it is very important that I here to show my support, and I think that's why I'm here.
Now, there's a fairly rapidly growing African community here in Lowell. Now, do most of these people work?
Yes. I would say most of us do work, and as a matter of fact, we have two or three jobs. So we work very hard, we pay taxes, we are really law-abiding citizens of greater law, and we contribute a lot.
A lot of the hospitals and nursing homes and homes for the elderly have staff that are African, I've noticed. Is that true?
Yeah, it's very true. Most of the Africans do work at nursing homes, elderly homes, and agencies as well. I do work at LifeLinks, which is an agency that support people people with disabilities. And we do a lot. We do offer a lot, and we work very, very hard. And we just want to be a part and parcel of this great nation.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Now, you're part of an organization.
Yes, I belong to the Elio Church, and also I'm very active in the community. I'm the second vice president of the Ghana Association in Greater Boston.
We want justice. My name is Gus Warrior. I live in Lowell, Massachusetts. Yep.
And you were saying we want justice. What did you mean by that?
I see a lot of injustices when it comes to the treatment given to immigrants in this country. I have observed that the people of this country have neglected the immigrant community in that they fail to realize the contribution immigration made to the society. They work hard, they pay taxes, and some of these people have kids here, they cannot go back home. And one reason I'm here, the main reason I'm here is that most of these immigrants cannot see healthcare, you know, services because they feel that when they go out there for medical treatment, they will be apprehended by the immigration and they stay here with diseases, and this is very detrimental to this country. This issue of immigration have to be addressed because these people are really contributing to this society in some way.
Are you an immigrant?
Yeah, I'm from Liberia originally. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you work here in law?
Yeah, I work in law. I work two jobs. This is why I'm here. The immigrant works so hard and pay taxes in this country. I work two jobs.
Yeah, what kind of work do you do?
I provide security for South Station in Boston, and I work with people with mental disability.
I'm Chip. I'm with Coalition for a Better Acre.
And you were saying that we want justice. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that on today, on May Day especially, it's really important to understand that it's a celebration of the workers of the world, and that means international. And when speaking in international terms, it means inclusive to everybody, and the way things are run in this country, to make the resolution they want to pass to make it a felony to cross the border, I don't think that's justice.
And we're talking to Joy Cushman. She's with us at the Merrimack Valley Project. What is the Merrimack Valley Project?
It's a regional organization of faith congregations and labor unions who work together to get affordable housing and better jobs in the Merrimack Valley.
And why are you here then?
We're here, first of all, just because MVP stands for the basic dignity of human beings, no matter where they come from, but also because we've been working a lot on issues that affect immigrants, work issues. There are a lot of immigrants in the Merrimack Valley who work as temporary workers with no benefits and no job security, so we've been working on issues like that.
What's going on here today, then?
Well, this is just to say to the city of Lowell that the people of Lowell, the congregations of Lowell, support the immigrants of the city.
I come here for help for all immigrants because no is criminal. It's only coming for work in United States and liking because it's nice country.
Where are you from?
Colombia.
Uh-huh.
Nice.
And what's your name?
My name is Miriam.
Okay.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido.
Oh, my name is Marcia Strauss.
And why are you here, Marcia?
Because I'd like to support the immigrants in this country. I think this country was built on immigrants and continuing to be built on immigrants, with immigrants coming from all different parts of the world just to add to the beauty of the melting pot.
And are you an immigrant?
Yes, I am.
And where are you from?
Brazil.
How long have you been here, Marcia?
24 years.
Uh-huh.
If they stop and deport everybody, lots of business will close, lots of taxes will be lost, and a vital section of this country will shut down.
The people united will never be defeated.
El pueblo unido jamás será.
I'm talking to Chris Tilley and Lenore Azaroff. They both come from the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Why are you folks here? What's going on?
Well, first of all, almost everybody here in the United States is descended from immigrants. My grandparents came over from Italy, Germany, Wales, and so it's part of the history of the United States. But I think more specifically, there's an implicit deal that's being broken. The implicit deal is you come, you work hard, you become part of the country. And the kinds of laws like the Sensenbrenner law are saying, no, we brought you here under that deal, but the deal's off. Now we're going to kick you out. And I just think, you know, that's wrong. And all the emphasis on it's illegal, it's legal, that was basically the deal. It's the same basic deal that our grandparents and great-grandparents came over on, and that deal should stand.
And Lenore, why are you here? And what's going on?
Well, we're all immigrants. My grandparents were immigrants. My stepfather's an immigrant. And anytime any of us buys food in a store or wears clothes or lives in a house, we're all benefiting from all the hard work that immigrants do. So it doesn't make any sense to divide us up and pretend like we have to attack other people because they're immigrants. And we all need to work together to get better wages, better jobs, better world.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, can I add one more thing?
Okay, we're talking to Chris Tilley.
Yeah, now just one more thing is that I think sometimes the history gets forgotten, so that, you know, pretty much all of us came here from immigrants, and if you look back 100 years ago, what was happening with immigrants then? There was a lot of illegal immigrants. There was a lot of welfare benefits being offered to immigrants. There was a lot of controversy about whether immigrants should stay and whether they destroy the culture of the United States. A lot of the same things were happening, but the United States got stronger for it. And so I think people sort of say, well, you know, my grandparents came over, but they did it the right way. If they look back at the actual history, a lot of the story is pretty much the same. And it's the story of this country. It's really what makes this country great. And so I hope we'll continue that story.
Okay, thank you, Chris. I saw a sign that says that Christopher Columbus was an illegal immigrant. Is that true?
Yeah, I think if you ask the people who were living here then, they'd pretty much say, yeah, that was true.
From the streets of New York City, across the ocean and beyond, people from all nations create a common bond. With our conscience as our weapon, we are witness to the fall. We are simple, we are brilliant, we are one and we are all. Here I go, bound for freedom, may my truth take the lead. Not the preacher, not the Congress, not the millionaire, but me. I will organize for justice, I will raise my voice in song, and our children will be free to lead the world and carry on. Here I go, bound for freedom, may my truth Congress, not the millionaire, but me. I will organize for justice. I will raise my voice in song, and our children will be free to lead the world and carry on.
That was WUML's Thinking Out Loud coverage of the Lowell, Mass. Rally for Immigrant Rights on May Day 2006. The feature ends with a segment of Pat Humphrey's Bound for Freedom. You're listening to Making Waves. Next, we have Eddie from Ohio with their song, Candido.
The sun will rise in the east, and I will raise my eyes to the canyon. As the campfire dies, my medic eyes asleep and dreaming of home. She is asleep and dreaming of home. But home is here in the canyon. It is red clay and dust and no rain. And when I have a son, he will know where he's from. I'm a man, and I have a name. I am a man, and I have a name. My name Candido. And I ran. There's my Mexican blood in American mud. I am running as fast as I can. I'm still running as fast as I can. 'Cause there's nothing left for me in the old country. Just heartbreak and shame and old truth. If there's life to be found in this angel of sounds, I'll find it for you. I will make us a new life, America. Forget Mexico. As the campfire dies, my America lies awake, dreaming of home. She is awake and dreaming of home. But I'll sing, oh, 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 oh.
Was Eddie from Ohio with Candido. Now for an immigration reform panel, Politics, Race, and Nation. It was recorded by the LA Sound Posse.
The following panel discussion is entitled Politics, Race, and Nation, What Immigration Reform Means. The talk was recorded at USC on April 26, 2006. The first speaker is David Lloyd, USC professor of English.
This forum has been stimulated quite obviously by recent debates and demonstrations around the question of immigration. Stimulated themselves by the Sensenbrenner Bill in Congress, number H.R. 4437. According to the National Council of La Raza, this bill would firstly make it more difficult for legal immigrants to become U.S. citizens. Secondly, disrupt American communities and put all Americans at risk, legal risk that is, by broadening the definition of smuggling to include anyone who aids or transports an undocumented immigrant. Thirdly, make everyone who comes to the U.S. to work subject not only to deportation, but to imprisonment in the U.S. And fourthly, disrupt the U.S. economy by creating an overly broad and retroactive employment verification system without creating legal channels for needed workers to work lawfully. In reaction to this draconian legislation that has just passed through Congress, over the past few weeks, 500,000 people came out in the streets of LA, 500,000 in Dallas, 200,000 in DC, not to mention 3,000 in Garden City, Kansas, with a population of 30,000. This may have been the most remarkable manifestation of organized civic dissent this nation has ever seen, and I think I'm not alone in saluting those who organized and participated, and in honoring the high school students and others who had the courage to walk out of school or off their jobs to defend their rights and the rights of others. These demonstrations were attended by people who have their origins in many countries and continents, citizens and non-citizens alike. This is, after all, a nation of immigrants, forced and voluntary, a nation founded on the theft of land and the genocide of indigenous peoples who occupied it and who recognized no borders, a nation made wealthy by the toil of slaves, of the indentured laborers, of immigrants and workers. And yet the recent debate continues to be framed as if it affected only the Latino population of this country, Mexicans, Central Americans, Latin Americans. It is indeed, of course, along the Mexican border that a 2,000-mile iron curtain is proposed, and it is primarily the 11 million undocumented workers from south of that border who will be penalized and criminalized. Little mention, for example, has been made of the thousands of undocumented immigrants from my own country, Ireland. And equally little mention has been made at the moment of the plight of immigrants from Haiti, a nation interfered with over and over again by American interventions and invasions. But what's more important still, and the reason for our panel, is the fact that immigration continues to be a confused and isolated issue. It appears as if immigration affects most of the population only so far as immigrants are accused of taking away jobs from Americans and lowering their wages. Perhaps, moreover, in the overheated imaginations of a few of the Minutemen, immigrants are the first wave of the Reconquista, que viva. Immigration has been the latest of a series of issues that seem to have swept across the headlines, each one displacing the previous day's concerns. Beneath them all is the specter of a failing economy as well as a failing presidency, the constant drumbeat of crisis, and the anxiety as to the future of American capitalism in a world where not only outsourced jobs, but the very center of gravity of economic activity may well be shifting to China or to India, while the Earth's resources, especially in oil and water, seem to be ever shrinking. We tend to confront and deal with all these issues, if we do at all, as separate and disconnected ones. The speed and soundbite quality of our news media encourages us to do so. Our panel today has been asked to talk briefly to the connections among these issues, to reflect on how they relate to one another both historically and in the present moment. And with an eye on the May 1st walkout and boycott, in which I hope everyone here will participate, how can we respond without being forced once again to divide and oppose one another? What possibilities are there of making coalitions across the divides that are imposed upon us? I think our panelists will speak to these and other issues in their own fashion, and then the floor will be open to your comments and your questions. The panelists are, and they will speak in this order, Ayanna McNair, who's a graduate student here in cinema and TV, Ricardo Ramirez, assistant professor in political science and the program in American Studies and Ethnicity, Fred Moten, who's professor of English and American Studies and current chair of African American Studies, and Janelle Wong, professor of political science and American Studies. Thank you all.
Greetings, everyone. Black folks are at war in this country, but the battle isn't against immigration, and the enemy is not undocumented workers, as you may have been duped into believing by corporate media. What is happening today has been going on for centuries, imperialism. Workers have been exploited for low, unlivable wages in the name of insatiable corporate profits. Since its inception, the U.S. has sacrificed the lives of people of color in its path towards global domination under a system of ruthless capitalism. The same capitalistic system that justifies slavery, which has been transformed over the years into prison industrial complex, is now not only justifying the continued exploitation of low-wage undocumented workers, but creates the problem of illegal immigration in the first place. The struggle for immigrant rights has been brewing for quite some time. The recent H.R. 4437, aka the Sensenbrenner Bill, which seeks to criminalize undocumented workers, is not only racist policy, but also a dangerous policy, for it will turn the struggle to provide for one's family into a criminal act and turn what purports to be a free, democratic society into a police state, where anyone who fits the profile of an undocumented worker is an open target. The U.S. is being very two-faced on this issue. It benefits from keeping these workers undocumented so that they can be exploited for cheap labor, but at the same time does not want the public to know that it exploits workers. So it presents immigration as this overwhelming problem. The recent immigrant rights marches and rallies are a result of immigrants finally being sick and tired of being the scapegoats for society's ills. Undocumented workers are not fleeing their countries of origin and making a difficult trek into the U.S. so that they can listen to Britney Spears and go to Disneyland. People are suffering in their home countries as a result of policies that come out of Washington, D.C., including trade agreements such as NAFTA and CAFTA, which is Central American Free Trade Agreement, which allow greedy U.S. corporations to exploit workers across the globe free of consequence. When you consider how bad conditions have to be to force people to leave their homes and work in the U.S. for pennies, or the fact that scores of Africans die every year at the hands of diamond cartels so that you can stay blinged up, you begin to see that poor people who are struggling to survive and feed their families are suffering worldwide so that a wealthy elite ruling class can keep getting richer. Black folks, an expendable segment of this society, as the police murder of Amadou Diallo illustrates, must recognize that we have no interest in defending racist policies driven by white conservatives that only benefit business elites, policies that seek to divide the working class. In order for black liberation to ever become a reality, we must remain focused on the true source of our oppression, which is not other oppressed workers, but rather the elite capitalistic power structure that seeks to exploit workers in the quest to further the cause of U.S. global domination. In the end, we're struggling for the same thing, equality. Thank you.
What was some of the first things that came out in Los Angeles Times and some of the mainstream media? They turned to race, you know. It started with immigrants, and they said, where are African Americans? That's all. That was the primary question that we kept hearing. I wanted to expand it. It's not just where were African Americans, where were progressive Jews, where were the labor unions, where were a lot of people? The question is, they weren't there. Why weren't they there? Now I want to tie it back into something that she said. Well, the reality is, with a lot of these immigrants, they came here and are working hard, but one of the things that they're doing is keeping some of the cultural ties. They're not here listening to Britney Spears. They're listening to some of the music from their home country. So to maintain some of those cultural ties. So it makes sense that when an issue that directly impacts immigrants comes to the fore, where is it that they're able to mobilize around? Spanish language media, Spanish language radio in particular. So it's not surprising that that's the source of the mobilization that they had to realize, you know, if the LAPD said there were 500,000 people there, we pretty much know it was more around 700,000 people. But it's because they mobilized using Spanish language media that a lot of these civil rights groups that were around during the civil rights movement weren't there. Because of the language that was used to mobilize. So, how many of you have heard of the name Piolin? How about El Cucuy? How many of those same people that just raised your hands knew those names before the incidents that happened?
You forgot El Mandril.
Yeah, El Mandril, right? Yeah. Now, I'm going to pose an even harder question. How many of you know the name El Peladillo? That's a lot less people, right? So the reality is that in Los Angeles, this isn't a new phenomenon of using media to mobilize immigrants. It was already done. Think back to the early 1990s. What was the biggest thing that happened? There was a new radio station, KLAX, and it took everybody by surprise by the number of listeners that they had and that they were able to mobilize. And that morning show became the top-rated morning show in all the country. And there was a backlash by the mainstream media, by Rick Dees, you know, suggesting like, basically saying it's a bunch of illegals listening to this music. There was a lot of backlash to his comments, but the reality was there was that sense that they could use this media to mobilize. Now, did they use it the same way the second go around? No, they didn't. There was a wider variety, and what they used it for during the mid-1990s, and 1994 in particular, was El Peladillo and his co-host in the morning, they vilified Pete Wilson. And now they weren't the only ones responsible for vilifying Pete Wilson, but they brought him into the minds of a lot of people in the policies that he wanted to proceed with. So it was used in the early and mid-1990s, and it was used now. The way that the issues are being framed between the mainstream media and Spanish language media are really, I guess they're really set apart, and there's a big drift between them, where the mainstream media keeps wanting to make it into a race issue. Now, I pose it to you guys, you know, and I hope that this will come up. How much of this actually has to do with race? How much of it is with immigration? How can we disentangle both of them? Because a lot of times these issues wind in with one another. So it's one thing that I hope we discuss.
Just in the spirit of asking y'all, you know, obnoxious questions about who you've heard of and who not. And the reason I say it's obnoxious is because I always do this in my class and they always get mad at me because they're like, why should I have heard of this music you were listening to in 1967? But how many of y'all know who Fannie Lou Hamer is? Okay. Well, the reason I bring Fannie Lou Hamer up, she was a woman who worked as a sharecropper on a plantation in a town in the Mississippi Delta called Ruleville. And she decided, along with some other people who she worked with in 1963, to attempt to register to vote in Indianola, Mississippi, which was the county seat for the county that she lived in. And she was arrested, beaten, basically because she made a decision to refuse to accept what she called second-class citizenship. She's a hero of the civil rights movement. She founded something called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which challenged the legitimacy of the Mississippi Democratic Party at the 1964 Democratic Convention in Atlantic City. She wanted to be seated as the legitimate representatives of the state, insofar as she felt that the Mississippi Democratic Party was illegitimate because they refused to acknowledge the right to political participation on the part of a vast number of that state's citizens. So a whole lot of what Mrs. Hamer was about was attempting to refuse the ongoing refusal of her rights as a citizen. But once the Voting Rights Act was passed and once black folks in Mississippi had at least more access to political participation, she didn't stop her activism. She spoke out, for instance, against the Vietnam War strenuously. There's a famous speech of hers at the University of California, Berkeley, in which she basically, I think, is moving beyond refusing to accept second-class citizenship into an even more radical political stance, which is namely to refuse first-class citizenship, insofar as what first-class citizenship has meant historically has been kind of quiescence, a quiescent acceptance of imperial expansion at home and economic exploitation, or imperial expansion abroad and economic exploitation at home. And it seems to me that right now, it's a really crucial moment in the history of Afro-American struggle, insofar as this immigration struggle gives us an opportunity, gives black folks an opportunity to act as if we were going to follow in the footsteps of Mrs. Hamer, which means not just to refuse second-class citizenship, but refuse first-class citizenship as it has already been constructed, right? So that if what it means to be a citizen is to get involved in all kinds of ridiculous nativist formulations about these people coming here and taking my stuff, mine, what we need to do is to refuse this ridiculous and silly and racist and evil discourse about mine, right? As if this land could be thought about under the rubric of anything like ours, right? For anybody. In other words, part of what's at stake, it seems to me, is to refuse that kind of ridiculous set of formulations which implies that citizenship is all bound up with ownership. Insofar as we know that in 1789, citizenship was deeply bound up with ownership, and the thing that was being owned was us, right? So we need to be careful and to think clearly about what kinds of historical discourses we are aligning ourselves with if we fall into the trap of a kind of nativism and a kind of anti-immigrant nativism which implies precisely the kind of citizenship that Mrs. Hamer was refusing. One of the ironies of Sensenbrenner's bill is that it criminalizes flight from the very vicious conditions of U.S. imperialism. And the irony, of course, is that when people flee from those conditions, they flee to the place which authors those conditions. Obviously, part of what's at stake, of course, is that that particular itinerary just replicates an itinerary which black folks know something about. We've been fleeing the conditions of U.S. imperialism forever ourselves. I mean, we are a fugitive people, right? Not a nativist people. Or at least it seems to me that we are when we accept what is essential to the best elements of our political tradition. And it seems to me that we need to maintain that. There's this vicious irony that somehow, at the very moment when it seems as if some of us seem intent upon claiming illegitimate forms of citizenship, that there are also these battles between blacks and Latinos in prison, whether that prison is New Orleans or Folsom, right? And the battle is between folks who are basically relegated to the permanent status of non-citizens, fighting over the fruits of an illegitimate citizenship in the first place that they'll never actually have access to. And it seems to me that especially with regard to New Orleans, we need to think back to the historic convergences of African and Latin cultures that go back before Columbus, that are at the very foundations of the cultural essence of New Orleans in the first place, right? That what we need to do is to think not just about those origins, but the immediate post-Columbian nature of, let's say, Mexico. There were 500,000 African slaves that were imported into Mexico in the 16th and 17th century. We need to consider and to think about that, that there are like historical reasons why not just this particular conflict between blacks and Latinos, but the very notion that there is some fundamentally essential difference between the two groups has to be called into question, not only as a function of history, but as a function of what we claim or what we want to claim for our futures. Right? So anyway, I just want to make sure that we start to think about these things, you know, maybe in a different way. You know, start to call into question the Lou Dobbs formulation of this problem, right? Because we're more informed than Lou Dobbs. We're smarter than Lou Dobbs. You know, we look better than Lou Dobbs. And we ought not allow ourselves to be duped by Lou Dobbs, right? So I just hope happens tonight is that we begin to formulate for ourselves some better ways and some more humane ways of thinking through this particular issue, and stop allowing ourselves to get caught up into a discourse in which we defend something called home, which was never really our home, right? And if we stop defending this already existing thing called home, we might actually make it possible for us to turn this into something that we will want to call home. So.
So there's two sheets that I'm passing out. One is on the legislation that is currently being considered in the Congress. The second has to do with two questions that I'm going to address in my remarks, which is, do immigrants take the jobs of native, especially black American workers? And do immigrants drive down wages? What does the research say? So I want to talk a little bit about the empirical evidence that is not being focused on too much in this debate, but which I think is important for us all to consider. Okay, the bill that most of the panelists have been talking about today is the Border Protection, Anti-Terrorism, and Illegal Immigration Control Act of 2005. That's a Sensenbrenner bill. Focuses it on enforcement. You keep hearing this word criminalization. It would increase civil and criminal penalties for knowingly in hiring or employing illegal workers. It establishes mandatory minimum sentences for immigrants without documents who re-enter the country. It also expands the border. So that bill really focuses on enforcement, border enforcement, and criminalization. It has passed in the House, and that's where that bill is now. The other bill that is being considered in the Senate, if you flip the page over, is the bill being sponsored by Senators McCain. McCain is the originator of this bill, and Kennedy. And that bill focuses primarily on instituting a legalization process that such that immigrants without documents who have lived in the U.S. for 5 years or more could attain citizenship if they remained employed, had background checks, et cetera. And then there are some different conditions for those who've been here a shorter amount of time to become citizens. It also includes a temporary worker program, and it also includes civic courses for new immigrants. This bill is at the very first stage in the legislative process introduced in the Judiciary Committee. Now, that bill needs to be worked out by the senators, and then there would be another step where the House and Senate bills would have to be reconciled somehow before any legislation moves forward. And what does President Bush want? President Bush originally emphasized border security and a guest temporary worker program. Originally, his plan did not include a legalization component, but now it does. So just to give you some background about where we are. If you look at the next sheet, I just want to talk briefly about the two issues that seem to come up the most in terms of a kind of, I think, divide and conquer politics, which is what is the threat that immigrants represent to a native population? And particularly, I think, many people who are arguing against more liberal immigration laws are putting forth the idea that perhaps immigrants might be taking away the jobs, especially of African Americans in the United States. Secondly, that they're driving down wages. And I just wanted to present some of the data. One is a false dichotomy that immigrants are not black and blacks are not immigrants. Obviously, we've had a huge wave of immigration from Africa, the Caribbean, in the last 20 years, and now census statistics show that more African immigrants have arrived since 1990 than were brought to the U.S. as slaves prior to the early 1800s. In New York City in 2000, 30% of people of African origin were foreign-born. The research by economists shows that immigration has an overall positive effect on the economy, but there's also a consensus that it is likely the case that immigrants hurt in terms of providing some kind of competition might compete for jobs with the lowest paid workers in the economy. But the argument is about the degree of that competition. So for instance, if you look at this data, a recent Rand study showed that immigrants mainly compete with those in the lowest paying sectors and depress wages by about 3%. A big study that got a lot of attention from Harvard by Borjas and Katz estimated that the effects were larger. But those same researchers also note that since 1980, of the estimated 8 million immigrants without documents that have entered the workforce, 2/3 never completed high school. Well, the percent of native-born people who have not completed high school has been shrinking rapidly, so that the point of this research is that the competition of immigrants with the native-born is immigrants competing with a smaller and smaller proportion of the native-born. And there's a lot of conflicting data. In 2005, an economist at UC Berkeley, David Card, compared cities that have lots of less educated immigrants with cities that had very few and found no wage differences driven by immigration. In a 2001 article, a sociologist, Nelson Lim, found that there was little evidence that there's a direct displacement of black workers due to Latino immigrants because they're actually in different sectors of the economy. Now, he leaves open the possibility that that can change. And even if we're thinking about in those terms of displacement, I think it's also important to look at other kinds of forces that are driving competition among workers. One is that there's a very compelling study by a famous sociologist, Roger Waldinger at UCLA, where he shows that it's employer attitudes that often drive who gets hired in jobs, and that employers are likely to see Latinos as a passive, pliable workforce compared to African Americans, who he found evidence that employers were looking at African Americans as a more demanding workforce that was going to be always asking for higher wages, and that this was really one of the forces that was driving competition and driving African Americans out of particular sectors. Do immigrants pay more taxes than they cost in public services? Most, but not all, studies seem to be persuaded that immigrants pay more taxes than they receive in public services. But it's quite nuanced in that there are some studies that show if immigrants have children, and you're looking at those immigrants that have kids who are under 20 years old, if their kids are in public school, then those immigrants might be using some services than they are paying in taxes. But this is only looking at that particular family, not in the direct cost of the taxes you're paying, the services you're using. It does not account for the fact that immigrants might be creating new jobs, that immigrants are spending their money on supporting local economies, and it doesn't take into the fact that immigrants actually increase the purchasing power quite a bit of the most well-off, as they provide very cheap services for the well-off. So I just wanted to end with this interesting public opinion data I found yesterday, which shows that a recent March 2006 survey, which is was a rigorous survey, shows that blacks were more likely than whites to say that they believe that immigrants are taking jobs away from Native Americans, but that blacks were also more likely to say that they didn't think that immigration should be cut back. So it's a fairly complex story, and I think we only hear part of the story. Secondly, a more recent field poll conducted this month shows that more blacks than Latinos support giving undocumented workers the opportunity to become citizens. And that was quite striking to me. More blacks than Latinos and more blacks than whites support liberalizing our citizenship laws. So I'll end there.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. You can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org.
You're listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.